This is Corbett Kraler, Mr. Sustainable, for EnvironmentalGraffiti.com. Today is May 31st, 2008, and with me is Justin Sutton, inventor of the Interstate Traveler, founder of the Interstate Traveler Company, and recipient of the prestigious Sir Isaac Newton Award from the American Computer Science Association. Justin was kind enough to agree to a brief interview for Environmental Graffiti about the hydrogen superhighway. Justin, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Corbett, for the invitation to provide some new inspiration and more light on the topic of the coming hydrogen economy.
The pleasure is mine. So, from glancing at the website interstatetraveler.us, visitors gain a quick understanding that your goal is to provide a hydrogen superhighway for the world. That's a bold humanitarian vision. What inspired you to provide something so broad and aggressive?
An excellent question. What inspired me? Well, it's obviously not a quick answer, and it's been a very long journey to come up with the vision as it is shown today. The original idea began on March 19th, 1995, while I was involved in both studying at university, working as an entrepreneur in the state of Michigan, certainly employed in the building trades, you know, to make a living while to pay for school. But I was also studying all the popular business psychology of the day, which is pretty much still the standard popular business psychology even today. And I also had subscribed to a lot of typical news magazines, like people would get at a newsstand. And right around that time, as I was reading a book, a fictional account about a transcontinental railroad company trying to survive the Great Depression here in the U.S., I was looking at magazines that were reporting the failure of America's passenger rail network because of changing economies, etc. So at that time, March 19th, 1995, all of the different experiences that I had merged into one giant piece of inspiration, and it had to do with answering the title of one of the newspaper articles, or one of the news magazine articles, that posed the question, who will fix America's passenger transit system? And, 1995, I was a young man, 5 years of college behind me already. So, of course, I was very aggressively pursuing my next career, and I answered the question with the words, I will. So, on that day, I made a list of over a dozen primary categories of necessary features and functions of a sustainable national rail transportation system that ran on solar power with embedded fiber optics and electrical distribution cables so that the system could do automatic load balancing as it spread across the U.S. And what we see now today is the evolution of about 8 years of private study as I worked on this from, 7 years, as I worked on it from 1995 to the year 2002, when I published a very large business summary, technical summary, describing how the entire system would function, published it with the Small Business Administration, and proceeded to continue publishing in traditional newspapers. By the time that happened, I had realized that for the system to be completely integrated, we had to have water, sewer, electricity, fiber optics as basics. But while we're putting together this conduit network inside of the rail, we might as well have conduit for hydrogen, oxygen, gasoline, diesel, propane, methane, biodiesel, all the traditional consumables of modern society today. It was only a simple step to take to integrate those as well as the basics for running water and flushing toilets. Once all those things were put together, it turned into something, as they say, the sum of its parts are greater than the whole, I think is the phrase, or maybe it's the other way around. But certainly when all these things are put together, it performs a lot of things very well that we need, like producing clean water, producing energy, distributing energy safely, and also helping to balance out the financial gap between the taxpayer and the municipality, which is another topic. Hopefully that answers your question.
Most definitely. Well, shortly after you published, in 2004, I learned about your wonderful technology because of a brief news item I saw. It reported that a suburb of Detroit, Michigan, around about where you live, had decided to build a hydrogen-powered commuter rail system into the city. However, the interstate traveler is much more than a transportation system. So would you tell us a little bit more about what the other capabilities are?
Absolutely. As I mentioned, the integration of all these pipelines for basic utilities so that each traveler station where people would enter and exit the system would have fresh drinking water and of course, sanitary systems and electrical systems and communication systems like a typical house would. Most homes today in modern cities, have all of those functions. So once all these things were put together, we saw that it could perform very important tasks for very large districts of people, not just self-sustain the rail network itself and the traveler stations that would allow a pedestrian or someone in an automobile or a freight shipper to access the system via these traveler stations. It turns out that there was enough surplus capacity that we could actually provide municipal services to places that either don't have municipal services or certainly would need more capacity, because it's a very strong fact that across the United States and elsewhere around the world, the municipal systems built by the previous generation and maybe 2-3 generations back in some cases or even further, you go to some older cities that are over 100 years old, they've got water pipelines, sewer pipelines that are 200 years old in some places. So we have this capacity to provide those types of services, but wherever this rail goes, it could be going across the Gobi Desert, could be going across the Sahara Desert, could be going through the Badlands, could be going through Death Valley, could be going in many different places that are considered inhospitable and dangerous and difficult territories, and provide water and sewer, electricity, and all of those things from the conduit cluster embedded in the rail itself, and provide a place where we could literally make the desert bloom with food that grows from compostable soil made from the destruction of the sewage that comes through the system. It ends up being quite an amazing a cycle of, what we would basically look at as kind of a biological cycle that all municipalities have. They take in water, we flush our toilets, they go through a sewer system and theoretically get processed. Unfortunately, a lot of today's sewer systems are overwhelmed and they end up polluting local waterways and creating sickness and death in some cases. So all of those things together enable the interstate traveler to provide a better power distribution, a better water purification system, a better sewer system that actually produces valuable commodities from the processing. So if we're processing sewage, we're making fertilizer. If we're processing, waste water, we're making clean water and also hydrogen and oxygen that can be piped through the system as a commodity. So, they can be available for a consumer, which is the final step so that people can understand how this pipeline actually provides service to the general public. When this rail network is running through, say, the interstate highway network of the United States, that's pretty much where everybody lives these days. It used to be people followed the railroads. Now they follow the interstate highways. And at the entrances and exits to the highways is where you find gas stations and other places to buy things. They have to have their product trucked in most cases. With the interstate traveler built on the interstate highway network, we can provide this pipeline directly to all of the gas stations adjacent to the interstate highway and further in, as we can lay additional pipeline later in the future, so that every gas station next to the interstate highway network will have a pipeline for gasoline, diesel, biodiesel, methane, hydrogen, oxygen, propane, natural gas, and of course, water and sewer is a basic function, would all be tapped in by the local distributor. So the fueling station's already built in. We don't need to worry about building those. They already exist. We're just providing them with additional pipeline. So, yes, it's more than just a transportation system. It is a unification of municipality infrastructure. And then as the financial mechanism works, it allows the general public to enjoy the services of transportation at high rate of speed at a third of the cost of driving an automobile. And then that money is distributed evenly amongst all the municipalities in the state on a per capita basis, as well as structured from the counties and the cities, the state and the federal. Everybody gets paid. So it's a very, very valuable system in many ways.
So this addresses most, if not all, of the energy, infrastructure, and transportation issues which are most pressing in the year 2008.
Yes, it's about connectivity, really. You know, we have an incredible society. Mankind has done an amazing thing to produce and redistribute the commodities of life, and the wheeled vehicle certainly is the bridge of success, should I say, that enabled humanity to grow the way it has. If everybody had to be a hunter and gatherer, certainly. You know, our populations would have remained very small. But now we have an obligation to our fellow man to take the systems that we have and make them a little bit better. But certainly the interstate traveler, even if it was built all the way across the country in hundreds of thousands of miles, maybe to millions of miles within a couple of decades, even in its combined capacity with today's solar panels, let's say if we did the entire interstate highway network in the U.S., it would represent probably 6% of the total quadrillion BTUs of the U.S. economy. Because our nation is so large, other countries are so large, that it doesn't really take away from anybody's business. It just makes it easier for the existing companies to distribute their product and allows us actually to wean away from the more harmful products, because people can purchase hydrogen or gasoline at the same time or different times of the day, whatever happens to be cheaper that day because of availability. So it is the bridge from the old fossil fuel to the new hydrogen economy. And it's all just a simple pipeline, no more complicated than the plumbing in your house. It's interesting.
Well, with so many diverse merits and solutions integrated into a single platform, I have to assume that the interstate traveler will involve hundreds, if not thousands, of skilled laborers to build, maintain, and operate, right?
Yes, sir. That's one of my favorite points about this. When I first realized that my list of categories that I put together in 1995, I guess when I did them then, I realized, well, this is going to take me 10 years just to build a business plan. And, it only took me really 5 years to build a business plan and do all the mathematical modeling of, how much steel, how much, copper, how much aluminum, how much plastic, time to produce, down to, cost per ton mile, how much energy would be required for levitation, how much energy comes in, how much goes out, how much loss. Once you figure out all of those things using really basic arithmetic in most cases, you come up to a position where you figure out, okay, we've got everything nailed down. I know what it's going to cost. I know how much material is required. How many people will it take to build and operate this thing? And I'll give you the example of Detroit to Ann Arbor. Detroit to Ann Arbor is about 25 miles if you were to fly it. But the highway network that connects Detroit to Ann Arbor consists of primarily I-94, which goes by Detroit Metro Airport and Willow Run Airport, which is under a multi-county development program for an aerotropolis to connect the two airports together with high-speed rail, and the two airports, which are then connected to the two cities of Detroit and Ann Arbor. The highway network that serves around Detroit is I-75 and I-94 primarily, and then around Ann Arbor is, of course, I-94, M-14, and US-23. When we laid it out on the map, it consisted of about 90 miles of rail, which includes the main lines, side tracks, and what we call a minor loop, which is a store and forward buffer for cars waiting at a traveler station. This enables us to have a system that never has any obstructions. You can cycle through it no matter what level you're at. The 90 miles would be served by 84 10,000-square-foot traveler stations. These 84 traveler stations are built inside of the cloverleafs that allow a wheeled vehicle to access the interstate highway network, which we're all familiar with driving onto a cloverleaf to accelerate and enter, you know, the traffic on an interstate highway network, or, of course, to decelerate and exit, and, of course, be queued up at the light. Inside of those landlocked portions of land, sometimes there, in many cases, there are what they call a borrow pit, where soil has been excavated to build the highway, and it's then flooded with outwash from the highway when it's rained, and that outwash is polluted with, you know, contaminants from the, you know, fossil fuel-based vehicles and other things that may have been spilled on the highway, you know, salts and things like that up here. So building all these traveler stations, building the rail, constitutes an enormous number of jobs from the civil engineers that fit the building inside of the cloverleaf, because they're all different. They all require a group of civil engineers to lay out the foundations. It requires groups of architects to design the buildings according to local desire. As you know, if your village has a certain Hamlet appeal or a certain modern appeal or a certain, you know, maybe European feel, your local government will want to have a traveler station that matches the local economy. So once those decisions are made, then the buildings are all built. There's 84 of them. 84 of those things would have at least 10 toilets apiece. So, of course, that's 840 toilets that are, you know, purchased and installed and by professional pipe fitters and so on. Then once they're built, let's say each one of them has three leasehold entrepreneurial franchise businesses. So if you've got 84 traveler stations times three, it's 252 new businesses, 252 brand new entrepreneurial business opportunities. On a, you know, could be a franchise, could be a brand new prototype franchise. And if they each had 10 employees, well, you're looking at 2,520 new permanent jobs just to provide entertainment and hospitality to the people that would be enjoying riding this 90-mile network that connects Detroit to Ann Arbor, to Detroit Metro Airport, to Willow Run, and the shopping centers and districts for housing and everything along the way. And, of course, connect to sports venues as well, the universities and the hospitals as well. They will all have access to the system, which enables many things to improve. The vehicles that would ride the rail, which is the final step in how many jobs it would be created, is, say, 300 vehicles on that system, about three vehicles per mile, roughly. Each one will have a concierge that is on the vehicle at all times, sort of like an air marshal service, but somebody there, you know, it's maybe more like a steward or stewardess position on an airplane, that they're there to be kind to you, they're there to give you CPR if you're having a heart attack, give you the Heimlich maneuver if you're choking, protect you if someone's attacking you, and perform necessary evacuation procedures should there be some calamity that, like a tornado or something that makes a direct hit, rips out a section of rail and a vehicle is trapped. It, you know, that professional concierge would be there to perform those services, and of course act as a public witness. So there's 300 cars on the system, and there's at least, say, four concierge per vehicle. So you're looking at 1,200 new permanent jobs just on the concierge level. And then, of course, each of the 84 traveler stations will have concierge as well, so the number just increases. And then the continuing supply chain that supplies the factories that build the rail and the continuing growth of hundreds of thousands of these traveler stations all over the U.S. Represents an enormous, enormous jobs growth program, jobs creation program, pretty much unmatched by anything else in world history in many ways, for the production of materials, the movement of people, products, and ideas, and the creation of permanent service jobs that provide an excellent living wage to give people access to health care, to hospitals, education, and better access to friends and family as well, because when you can ride this thing and be 200 miles down the road in an hour, that expands your transportation radius greatly, which, of course, also improves your opportunity to get a good job and make money.
Well, when we think about dining and entertaining just within the context of the traveler stations themselves, the closest parallel which comes to my mind is the dining car on a passenger rail system.
Yes.
But one of the most intriguing features of the interstate traveler, as you were describing it, its ability to combine the power of that rail-based system, where we also have the Amtrak Auto Train in the United States, which allows you to go with your automobile to specific destinations. It's a limited service, but sees great patronage. And as you know, it has the convenience of a commuter system to connect city centers with outlying communities, but most of the time it's used for long-distance travel. So people literally can drive their car onto this system and go where they need to go. But with the interstate traveler, they can do that once the system is fully constructed in any major city. So how much do you think it would cost the average driver to bring a car onto the interstate traveler for a daily commute of 30 minutes?
Excellent question. It always boils down to, is this thing going to be even worth having? Is it worth using? Does it cost so much that it's not worth riding? It's a very important thing about what it will cost to the consumer. We're familiar with public transit systems that are subsidized by the government that provide fairly reasonable service for fairly reasonable cost in most cases. But by and large, transportation is expensive. And we have it fairly cheap here in the U.S. So, and you mentioned the dining car and the auto train and the different types of services that are provided to people while they're riding a traditional railroad network, such as the various lines that run on the East Coast in the U.S. that provide dining cars and provide a train car for you to put your automobile on. Those are great services. And they do provide wonderful thing, an opportunity for people in that area, but they're limited, of course, because the railroads are boxed in. And it's really almost impossible to expand the railroad network in this country. So the highway network, of course, is the next logical step. The cost to a traveler, a pedestrian, or somebody in an automobile, is going to vary for two reasons: time and mass. Since this system is electric, we, of course, derive our power from the solar grid initially, but we buffer the energy in different forms of capacitors, primarily the production of hydrogen gas. Our costs are directly proportional to the weight, or should I say the mass, of a person or an object and the amount of time that we're levitating them down our rail system. An automobile, a fully loaded SUV with six NFL linebackers, is, you're talking probably 8,000 pounds or more, or maybe even 9,000 pounds for a full-size SUV with half a dozen linebackers. Or you could have a little tiny, the smallest car money can buy with two very small people in it that are on a way to a shopping spree or whatever in the neighboring city, and their combined mass is only 3,000 pounds. So you're talking triple the mass for the scenario A versus scenario B. So our costs, of course, would be increased by the same proportionality. If you have a typical automobile, let's say a sedan with two adults, it might weigh a combined weight of, say, 4,000 pounds. So in that case, we can estimate something like, say, 32 cents a minute to ride the system. So if you ride for 32 cents a minute times 60 minutes, you're looking at $19.20. What that means is that you and your loved one can drive your typical automobile into an interstate traveler car transport and be levitated at 200 miles an hour across the countryside following the interstate highway network and get 200 miles down the road for a mere $20. And you're in the privacy of your own home, own car, with your own personal objects about you, and it's your private space. It's personal rapid transit. As a pedestrian, riding a public transit system, and of course, having a concierge, and probably in a dining car where you'll be able to purchase, gourmet foods or hit a vending machine, that pedestrian would probably pay as little as 5 cents a minute. So at 5 cents a minute, in 60 minutes, you're talking about basically paying $3. That same 60 minutes can get a pedestrian down the road again about 200 miles, and it'll only cost them $3. Proportionally, compared to driving an automobile, it costs today easily $8 an hour to drive an automobile, just in the consumption of fuel. So if you're driving that medium-sized car, and let's say you're paying $6 an hour, well, in $6, in that 1 hour, you might get 50, 60 miles down the road. So in our case, for $3 an hour for a pedestrian, they can get 200 miles down the road for $3 in that same hour. That would take you $6 in a car and get you only 50 miles down the road. So for half the money, you go 4 times farther. It's a very, very wonderful system to enable mass transportation for people and people in their automobiles, freight, of course, the dining car you talked about, the mobile triage system that would bring hospitals to the scene of accidents, complete surgical teams, medical imaging, blood chemistry, everything could be brought to the scene of an accident in one of these vehicles. It's incredibly safe. The vehicles can't really be derailed because they wrap around the rail. So it provides a wonderful service that's very, very inexpensive and very, very safe. So again, to recap, you're looking at $3 an hour for a pedestrian and about $20 an hour for your typical automobile to ride the system.
Well, continuing with the thought of automobiles on this network, one of the reasons no alternative to the conventional rubber-on-asphalt transportation model we have today has gained global adoption is that the conventional way, the old way, works well in most any condition from desert to tropics to alpine applications. So how do you provide for the varying demands of the natural elements as you plan to build the interstate traveler throughout the United States and then the world?
Another excellent question. How will it work with the environment and straight up comparing it with the value of a wheeled vehicle? First of all, the wheeled vehicle is paramount. That has always been the best way to move around the world. Because you can pretty much roll a wheeled vehicle over just about any course without any problems, unless the terrain is so rough and the wheel doesn't fit over that landscape. So you either make a bigger wheel or have a track vehicle, which is still a wheeled vehicle, or you put down a metal rail and run a wheeled vehicle down a railway, which, of course, is incredibly successful and denotes our railroad system. Those have limitations, however. They require you to build a road bed, really. Driving efficiently over rough terrain was demonstrated by Eisenhower when he tried to take a caravan of U.S. military vehicles from East Coast to West Coast. And this is after the railroad network, of course, was created in the 1800s. But to demonstrate the condition of America's roadways, he took all these vehicles across the U.S., and it was a very arduous journey. So roads were built. Roads have to be built to optimize the wheel. In our case, the hydrogen superhighway is a elevated rail network that's installed from a vehicle that rides the rail itself. So we can go across the countryside and even into the most harsh environmental conditions without having to put a boot on the ground. The rail car that installs the rail rides on the rail and can drill the stanchion poles directly into bedrock, or pile drive the stanchion poles into soft sediments and put large cuff at the base so that it has a large compression area footprint, if you will, to keep the stanchion pole from compressing deeper into soft soil. This system can go anywhere, virtually any time, and pretty much take any grade of elevation. In comparison, an automobile can, probably climb a 30% grade or maybe even a 50% grade, and for sports fans. But going up what the equivalent of a 45-degree angle is very difficult for a wheeled vehicle. you reach a point where friction is overcome by gravity and you slide back down. The Interstate Traveler Rail Network, which of course is the hydrogen superhighway, the slotted linear motors that I designed for the system have the capacity to provide a typical individual motor, and one vehicle, of course, would have four motors if you refer to the illustrations on the website. Typical vehicle would have four motors. Each one can exceed 10,000 pounds of lateral thrust. So if you have a vehicle with four of these motors, that's a total of 40,000 pounds of longitudinal thrust along the rail. If the vehicle weighs 30,000 pounds, that's 10,000 pounds less than its maximum thrust, which would allow you to take a 30,000-pound vehicle and literally go vertically on the rail straight up a mountainside. Of course, I wouldn't advise that. It probably wouldn't be that much fun of a ride, maybe very thrilling, but it's somewhat impractical for typical use. And that means to say that compared to the trucks, the cars, the automobiles, the railroads, and building roads in general, cutting roads through mountainous environments, which is very difficult, dangerous, time-consuming, disrupts the structure of the mountain itself and can imbalance the stable craton and cause earthquakes, which, you know, has been predicted by some geologists, that all the dynamite necessary to cut a road through a mountain is just not necessary anymore. We can run this rail system through the harshest mountainous environments with having a near zero impact on the local environment and quietly, peacefully, cleanly provide high-speed transportation system to pretty much every corner of the known world, be it in the tundra, be it in the mountains, be it in the jungles. This thing is virtually inert to the local environment. It will bring no contaminants. And, just incidentally, it happens to have the ability to consume contaminated water. And so we can clean the environment as we go. And as I mentioned earlier, this water production distribution system means that we can grow food wherever the system goes. So it fits perfectly into the environment in many ways. So hopefully that answers your question.
Most definitely. You spurred a thought with a previous answer when you alluded to the fact that today's energy prices are causing people to pay at least $8 an hour to drive their car. And with those same impacts, we are seeing a drag elsewhere outside of automobile transportation, and that's the beleaguered American airline industry. The situation is reached a point, as I'm sure you know, that many carriers now are charging for all checked luggage. So with who knows what type of expense coming next, the interstate traveler seems a viable alternative to air travel, at least in some applications. Tell our listeners, if you would, what rule of thumb you offer to the passengers of the future so that they can judge whether to fly or ride.
Yes. There always comes a time when you have to weigh the value of a service, and if it's transportation, certainly it's, you know, time and money are the key features. An airplane can fly in any direction at a very high rate of speed, and over long distances, it can easily, you know, the commercial jet airliner can, with a good tailwind, you know, can do 500 miles an hour sustained without any trouble. So, you know, in 2 hours you can go 1,000 miles. That's an extraordinary service. However, the interstate traveler can theoretically provide that type of service, but to achieve 500 miles an hour on a fixed guideway has some challenges and some practicality issues, especially if you're following the interstate highway network. You quite frankly couldn't sustain that rate of speed because of the curvature of the traditional highway systems. But on the straightaway, certainly, you know, you get out in some of the larger states where you've got a highway that doesn't even have a turn in it for, you know, a couple hundred miles. In those cases, the interstate traveler could potentially reach a 500-mile-an-hour sustained rate for a few minutes. But, you know, we'll figure that out in the future. But if you're a traveler and you're trying to decide, well, should I ride the interstate traveler today, or should I take that, go to the airport and take an airplane? Certainly, the cost of fuel is an issue that drives the cost of the flight, and the interstate traveler pretty much has a fixed energy cost because it all comes in from the sun. So We don't have the throw in commodity pricing like we do with petroleum-based fuel systems. But if time is the issue, if you need to get somewhere fast, flying really can't be beat. But if comfort and safety and a nice view out the window of flying along at the treetop level but on a fixed guideway is more your speed, then you might not mind riding an interstate traveler as opposed to flying in an airplane. It certainly would be cheaper in some cases. At the time you go on to the interstate traveler, you would be able to look and instantly know the amount of time required for you to make your journey and what it would cost you, because the time is proportional, directly proportional. So let's say you get to a traveler station and you look and say, well, I want to get from Detroit to Denver. It's quite a long distance, and riding the interstate traveler is going to take me, you know, 4 hours, 5 hours, 6 hours, whatever it might have been. When you program in your destination, the interstate traveler operating system automatically does a hop count and traffic analysis between your point of existence to your point of destination, and it will give you a highly accurate but ever-changing, constantly changing number of, as an estimate of how many switches you'd have to go through, what your average rate of speed would be, and when you would get there, and what it would cost you. Then you could look at that and say, well, you know what? I think I better get on the airplane because it'll get me there faster. Or you can say, well, you know, I'd rather ride the interstate traveler and not be wedged into a seat that, for some odd reason, the airline industry seems to have invented the most uncomfortable seat that they force people to sit in, packed in like sardines. That'll never be the case with the interstate traveler. It's all about open space, comfort, passenger comfort. And again, we can have private cars, dining cars on the interstate traveler, where you can literally have a table place setting like the finest restaurant with a white tablecloth and five waiters per table filling your water glass an instant it's sipped on. And all those types of service can be provided in an interstate traveler vehicle. You don't really get that type of a service on your traditional airplanes, so especially when they hit, you know, turbulence, because your table would have been overturned and everything would have been spilled. We don't have that problem with the interstate traveler. So without going into numbers on the cost of fuel and average airplane, you know, ticket fees, I personally would pretty much choose the interstate traveler every time. But if I was in a hurry, I would take the risk of getting in an airplane, because, you know, what goes up must come down. It is, you know, statistically very safe, but it doesn't really compare to the safety of riding a fixed guideway. So it's kind of a tough choice to make, tough choice, you know, to try and describe hypothetically. But after the system's built, people will, you know, it'll actually take pressure off the airlines, because anything less than 500 miles in a flight for the airline companies quite often is a loss to the airline industry, because the amount of fuel they burn just to get up to cruising speed and then land again often can exceed the revenue they're getting from short hop flights. So the airlines will always benefit from and pretty much be the big choice to fly long distances, while the interstate traveler will take pressure off the airlines for the short hops that they lose money on. So when the two work together to serve the economy, we actually help the airlines make more money, because we take pressure off their short flights. And then, you know, the rest will kind of boil down to economics and availability. And then when you get to a holiday season and everybody wants to go visit family, both services, I'm sure, will be jammed. It'll be a good day.
Picking up on that thought of the long-distance routes, the newly liberalized North Atlantic airspace has been a boon to many carriers. But if people can't or won't fly between the United States and Europe, today really their only choices are to sail or swim, neither of which is particularly fast. Do you have plans to span oceans with the hydrogen superhighway?
Yes, we do. There, you know, I guess since time immemorial, man has been trying to find ways to build bridges over creeks, over rivers, over valleys, to enable, you know, us to get places faster and safer. You know, we build bridges, and then we actually started building tunnels. You know, we tunnel through a mountainside. You know, initially just maybe for aqueducts, like the Romans built aqueducts And they find a water source, and they had no problem tunneling through a mountain just to get the water flow to go, which, of course, led to tunneling for trains, and trains going through tunnels and mountains, and an automobile, so, of course, enjoying the same benefit. There have been many people that have proposed building a tunnel, if you will, through the ocean by prefabricating large tunnel sections, something, say, 100 feet long and 50 feet, let's say 100 feet long and maybe 30 feet in diameter. These sections would be fabricated in dry dock, floated out into the ocean, their buoyancy would be adjusted the same way a submarine's buoyancy is adjusted, and lowered down to, say, 250 feet below the surface of the ocean, bolted together, tethered to the seafloor with, you know, cables a mile long or whatever they would be. And once this entire assembly of, say, 200,000 of these 100-foot-long tunnel sections are bolted together, cinched down to the ocean floor with, proper number of cables, the tube would then be evacuated, and then you would have a bridge across the Atlantic Ocean that's under the water and uses buoyancy because of the evacuated space inside the tube makes it want to rise to the surface of the ocean, and the cables hold it down. So you have a very, very safe and reliable structure that is protected from the elements because it's 250 feet below the surface, where wave action would have very little effect on it. It's low enough that ships won't run into it, other than maybe, you know, submarines, but of course they would know exactly where the thing is in the first place. So once that bridge is built from east to west, the system could have a train running through it. It could, of course, have the interstate traveler running through it. And it's been known to science that something called a high-velocity air pressure to push or draw through this tube a vehicle of some kind. Some of the first subways ever built in modern cities like New York and London actually used air pressure to move the vehicle down the subway tunnel from one city block to another. Just a very, very simple device that allowed the vehicle to move through this tube without having any motor on it whatsoever. When you use a high-velocity air pressure, it can enable something like the interstate traveler vehicle, a maglev vehicle, to reach supersonic speeds inside of this tunnel. And, you know, these are ideas that have been proposed by people long before I ever got into the business, but I see the value in it, and I've been working on the financial feasibility of it, as many have. And I would predict that within a few decades, we'll probably see a very serious effort to do something like that, build those 200,000 prefabricated tunnel sections. But something like crossing the Bering Straits would be probably a lot cheaper and would probably be built first, which would be a land bridge between east and west. It just might be a longer distance to go from New York to London if you got to go clear around, you know, the globe. But what a great ride it would be on the interstate traveler. Going across oceans and seas is something that is on our radar screen. It's something that's very feasible scientifically. It's about whether it's commercially feasible or not. If the market's ready, it will happen. But building elaborate tunnels and elaborate undersea bridges of hundreds of thousands of prefabricated, you know, giant tube sections is kind of an industry unto itself, where the interstate traveler doesn't require that. Certainly crossing the ocean, it would be ridiculous to not use that type of technology. But following along, you know, shallow ocean environments on the ocean shelf, going between islands in these large archipelagos in the South Pacific, in the Bahamas, in the South China Sea, in these archipelagos are often connected, of course, underwater by relatively shallow seas. So we could run the interstate traveler rail system the same way we run it on the surface underwater, and in say 100 feet of water, so that the vehicle is maybe, you know, with the stanchion poles, the rail, and then the vehicle itself, the roof of the vehicle might be say 60 or 80 feet underwater, which allows the vehicle, you know, to not have to be pressurized and to not require exotic science to make it safe. You know, there are companies now that build, you know, private executive submarines that, you know, that are very reasonably priced in comparison to other things. So certainly spanning oceans in the large prospect of using evacuated tubes and bridges that float underwater is very real, but we can keep it simple, use the same infrastructure that we would use to go across the fields, the prairies, the mountains, the tundra. We can use that to just go in shallow seas as well and connect otherwise divided land because of a sea barrier. And, you know, many people love to sail and swim, but when a storm comes, you know, you don't want it to be the perfect storm that, you know, ends your journey. So, again, the interstate traveler provides a very safe, reliable method for transportation, even underwater. So it's got a lot of value, a lot of resources.
This has been a delightful conversation. Do you have any closing thoughts for our listeners?
Sure. First of all, I hope you have a chance to look at our website. There's a lot of links on the website. There's actually quite a few pages that you can drill down into. I invite you to take a look at all the different products listed on the products page. And if you scroll down to the bottom of the products page, there's a link that says Future Projects. When you open that page up, the one that's at the very top is the description of the hydroponic highway. That is the use of the Interstate Traveler Rail Network, as we've described today, as a means with which to grow food in the desert. This is a very critical humanitarian service that the Interstate Traveler can do very, very well and very, very cheaply, and work sustainably and reliably for hundreds of years without maintenance. Today, as you know, we listen and talk over the Internet, there are hundreds of thousands of people starving to death that don't have access to clean water and basic sanitation, let alone shelter, a roof over their head, and you know, if they're lucky, they might have a UN tent. And this is the case right now in many places in the world. Certainly there's places that have been devastated by hurricanes and other natural forces that the Interstate Traveler would be able to withstand in most cases and still provide running water and flushing toilets to large districts of people in harm's way. If you can go to the website, go to the products page, scroll down, click Future Projects, and look at the hydrogen superhighway as displayed as the hydrogen highway, you'll see a means with which to reconstruct soil in arid environments and create an oasis that is 100 feet wide by 1,000 miles long and help end this problem we have in this world of starvation and drought. That's probably the most important thing I would like to let your listeners think about as we wrap up our conversation.
Wonderful. That URL is interstatetraveler.us. And we've been visiting today with Justin Sutton, inventor of the Interstate Traveler, founder of the Interstate Traveler Company, recipient of the prestigious Sir Isaac Newton Award from the American Computer Science Association, and his homepage once again is interstatetraveler.us. This is Corbett Kraler, Mr. Sustainable, for environmentalgraffiti.com, signing off.